Human development is an issue of increasing concern on the exam. There seem to be increasing numbers of questions on this topic, and the questions are gaining in sophistication. This is an area where we really expect you to master one simple principle. What is normal? What does normal look like? What do children usually look like at each age and each stage of development? Issues about abnormality are postponed till step two, when you'll get those in pediatrics. But here, we want you to have a normal baseline. In order to understand human development, we begin with just making sure you have a sense of the structure of how we put this together. We first need you to understand that development does not occur in humans along a single dimension. Instead, it occurs, or think about it occurring, along a number of hopefully parallel but independent dimensions. Socially, occupationally, sexually, cognitively, personality. Ideally, there's some correlation about what's happening along these dimensions, but sometimes there is not. So when you're trying to track development, it's not one issue you're looking at, it's an array of different issues. You must have a broad spectrum approach. We track development for people using a simple concept called milestones. Milestones are marker times, and they're actually median times. When I say, for example, that a child should be crawling by 9 months of age, I do not mean all children are crawling by 9 months of age. I mean half of the children are crawling by 9 months of age and half crawl later. These are median times. And this is, of course, the bane of every pediatrician's existence, right? The parents who have little Johnny, who is 9 months and 4 days old, have gone to the local bookstore and have bought a book on child development. They look up in the book and it says, child crawling by 9 months of age, and in a panic they call the pediatrician going, but he's not crawling yet. And the pediatrician is, of course, supposed to say, don't worry, he's normal. Children develop at their own rate. If you're approximate around that milestone, you're fine. Do not take these milestones as written in stone. Take them as with some flexibility, with a confidence interval around them, if you will. Now, recent research about infants tells us a whole lot we didn't used to know about infants. There's been a ton of new information about infants over the last 20 years as we look in greater and greater detail with more and more sophisticated techniques. First, you should know that infants evidence certain things and certain capacities at birth. How old is the child when they have a reaching and grasping capacity? The ability to imitate facial expressions, the capacity to synchronize their limb movements with the speech or the movements of people around them, something we call coupling or entrainment. How old is the child when they can do crying and clinging behavior? Answer, at birth. On the exam, if they ask you those kind of questions, pick the earliest age they give you. All right, stay away from in utero, but other than that, pick the earliest age they give you, because the trend of the research is children could do more and more earlier and earlier than we ever used to think they could. Infants have clear preferences for stimuli at an early age. Newborns prefer large, bright objects with lots of contrast. Moving objects in particular get a following reflex. They prefer curves versus straight lines, and they like more complex rather than more simple designs. We often hang mobiles in young children's cribs, so the infant has something to look at. This is also a way for them to get practice at dealing with visual stimuli or stimuli in their visual field. Newborn, would they prefer a mobile that is a bright red and green or bright white and black? Well, the white and black is their preference because it's the contrast that matters, not the color. Adults seem to be more focused on color, but infants seem to be focused more on contrast. Newborns have a clear preference for facial stimuli. If you give them a choice to look at a bowling ball or your face, they'd rather look at your face. Even if we turn the finger holes forward, yes, they like facial stimuli. They even prefer drawings of faces to just other kinds of drawings early on. And this next one is quite fascinating. There's increasingly accumulating evidence that we are hardwired for language. we show clear, at a very young age, clear preference for language stimuli versus all other kinds of stimuli. Let me give you the strong version of this argument. The strong version is, we do not learn language. Instead, the right way to say is we learn to use the language that we're born with. The same way I don't learn to have a hand, but I learn to use my hand, that's what's happening for language. We are hardwired for language. At a young age, children will focus on language even if it's not a language they will ever understand. And even as an adult, if I bring up in front of you someone who speaks a language you have never heard before and someone who speaks total gibberish, you can probably tell me which is which. There are patterns. There are structures. There's an underlying grammar to language which we recognize because we seem to be hardwired to recognize it. Finally, you should know that at just 1 week of age, an infant can tell the mother from the father. How do they do that? It's all about smell, folks. Smell seems to be the most important sense when you talk about bonding between mother and child. Touching is, of course, important. Hearing and sight are important, but the most important sense for bonding is smell. Now let's talk about smiling. Children are born with the capacity to smile. We call this an endogenous smile. And by that, we want you to understand they're not smiling because they're happy. They're smiling because it's a reflex. It's simply what they do. We believe this is a result over the years of natural selection. Children that had this reflex got more care and more likely to survive, and so we've selected for smiling infants over the centuries. Children only develop an exogenous smile, that is, a smile in response to the world around them, by about 8 weeks of age, and a preferential social smile at about 12 to 16 weeks of age. What we mean by preferential social smile is that you're responding uniquely to particular people, like the mother, the father, instead of just anybody in the environment. When you're born, you have the capacity to smile, not because you're happy, but it's a reflex. It becomes a response to the external world about week 8, and becomes a preferential directed social smile by week 12 or 16. By age 3, you get the drawing of the circle, the cross and the rectangle in age 4, the square in age 5, the triangle in age 6, and the diamond by about age 7. By drawing that diamond, you know the child is age 7. Now, why is the diamond and the close neighbor the triangle, why are they learned so late? Why are these the last figures you learn? Simple. It's about diagonals. Diagonals are hard to draw. Learning to draw diagonals occurs relatively late. And so, there have been questions on the exam that give you the following information. Here is a stimuli which the patient is given as part of a neuropsychological test. They're asked to reproduce this figure by drawing it on their own piece of paper. The reproduction of the figure drawn by the patient looks like this. Based on this information, the question asks you, what can you most likely conclude about this patient? Well, you're given the option that it's an 85-year-old woman with Alzheimer's, a 65-year-old schizophrenic, it's a 22-year-old who's had a parietal lobe dysfunction, on and on. None of that is correct. This is simply a typical 5-year-old. Normal development. What's missing here in the reproduction? Diagonals. There's no pathology here. This is simply the normal response pattern that someone has achieved by age 5. We want you to know what normal is. There's a few terms that we want you to associate with early development, especially during infancy. We want you to know what the brain growth spurt is. Well, the brain growth spurt is a so-called critical period of development. Critical period means if something doesn't happen in that period, you can't make up for it later. It must happen then, or it's not going to be fully compensated for at a later time. The brain growth spurt is a period that lasts from the last trimester till about 14 months after birth, roughly a 17-month period total. This is, simply put, the time when the brain is most responsive, most sensitive to environmental stimulation. In response to this environmental stimulation, the brain gains increase in connections, the size of the neurons grow, and these connections become myelinated. Remember, your brain has, although it's a complex organ, your brain has a relatively simple job. Its job is to change its shape, structure, interconnectedness to make you most responsive to the world you find yourself in. The time when the dominant foundation of this process is laid is during the so-called brain growth spurt. If you're in a rich, stimulus-filled environment during this period, you get more brain maturity, development, and interconnectedness. If you're in an impoverished, stimulus, short environment, well, then this development does not happen. If at age 2, I take a child who has been kept in a closet without light or sound for many years, and I now bring them out into the world to interact with other children in a rich play situation, I cannot fully make up for the deficit, the brain growth spurt. You ever walk through the parks and you see pregnant women with large bellies, clearly close to delivery, sitting there with headphones on their bellies, playing Beethoven or Brahms or perhaps a French tape into the child who's in their stomach? Well, the reason for this is the research on the brain growth spurt. No, they're not really teaching the child to be a musician, nor are they teaching the child to speak French, but they are providing increased stimulation as part of this brain growth spurt period. Stranger anxiety and separation anxiety. Let's separate these two out and make sure you're clear about the difference. First, the sequence. It's stranger anxiety first, then separation anxiety. Stranger anxiety occurs about 6 months of age, peaks at about 8 months, and lasts until about 12 months of age. Usually disappears by the first birthday. Stranger anxiety means just what the name suggests. It's anxiety, fear, distress at the presence of somebody unfamiliar. You can have stranger anxiety in your mother's arms. It's not separation from your mother that's the issue here. It's somebody unfamiliar coming in that causes distress. Separation anxiety, by contrast, is, as the name suggests, anxiety, fear, distress of being separated from the primary caretaker. Stranger anxiety sets in, can be as early as 8 months, but usually, and for the exam, I want you to think about this as something for the second year of life. Stranger anxiety is 6 to 12 months. Separation anxiety roughly is 12 to 24 months. Separation anxiety is supposed to resolve itself. You're supposed to get over the anxiety of being separated from the primary caretaker. But you know what? Sometimes that doesn't happen. When that doesn't happen, when separation anxiety is not resolved, it reemerges as the child goes to school in what we call a separation anxiety disorder, or what we used to call a school phobia. The term school phobia is misleading. It has the connotation of a fear of school, and that's not correct. It's not a fear of school, it's a failure to resolve separation anxiety. And so your intervention with the school phobia, your intervention with the separation anxiety disorder is not in the school setting, it's in the home setting, helping the child and the parents to separate. And please note, it's almost always helping the parents to separate from the child as much as it is the child to separate from the parents. Imprinting. Imprinting. All you need to know about imprinting for the exam is this. It's not about people. Imprinting is attachment behavior in geese and ducks and quail, not people. It doesn't apply to monkeys, it doesn't apply to dogs, it applies to birds. Imprinting is a critical period in a bird's life. What we're talking about is simply this. During this critical imprinting period, the little duckling will follow the first large object that happens by. If it's you, then the little duckling is following you. You get tired of this little duck following you, and so you get a mother duck and you say, "Look, mother duck, mother duck." And then you let the mother duck go that way. You walk this way, the mother duck goes this way. Where does the little duckling go? It follows you. This is not an intelligence exercise. This is an instinct. They follow the first large object. Now, in the wild, this is a pretty reasonable thing to do, because in the wild, in the nature, the first large object the little duckling sees is the mother. It's just when we start screwing around with the duckling's life that they have some difficulty. You can imprint ducks, geese, quail on blowing pieces of newspaper, rolling balls of aluminum foil. It's not an intelligence exercise. It's merely an instinct to follow and continue to follow the first large object. What's the main thing to know about imprinting for the exam? It doesn't apply to people. Translation, it's not the answer to your question. It's a distractor.